WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Robert Wise, the director of films as diverse as West Side Story and The Day the Earth Stood Still, died last week in Los Angeles of a heart ailment. He was 91. Wise spent more than six decades in the movie business, winning two Oscars for Best Director. The son of an Indiana meatpacker, Wise dropped out of college in the Depression and went to Hollywood, where he got a job as a messenger in a studio editing department. He became a film editor and at age 26 edited Orson Welles' masterpiece Citizen Kane. As a director, Wise crossed genres with ease. His other films include The Sound of Music, The Body Snatcher, The Haunting, The Sand Pebbles, and The Andromeda Strain. When Terry Gross spoke to Robert Wise in 1989, he had just completed his 39th film, Rooftops. Wise's career surged in 1961 when he brought West Side Story from Broadway to the big screen. Here's the Jet song from the soundtrack of West Side Story.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out, let's get cracking.
Where are you gonna find Bernardo?
It ain't safe to go into PR territory.
We'll be at the dance tonight at the gym.
Yeah, but the gym's neutral territory.
Hey, Rab, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-o. So listen, everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony me at the dance at the 10. And walk tall!
We always walk tall.
We're jets!
The greatest!
When you're a jet, you're a top cat in town. You're a gold medal kid with a heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swingin'est thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king.
The jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clinking. The sharks are still clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken.
Here come the jets like a bat out of hell. Someone gets in our way, someone don't feel so well. Here come the jets, little world's
never. Let me ask you a few things about West Side Story. It seems that the biggest problem would have been in adapting the stage version to the screen. Mm-hmm. Is making... making the artificial seem natural, in the sense that on stage, everything is artificial. Whereas when you're shooting on real locations, like the streets of New York, it could look really stagey and artificial to gang members breaking into song and dance. So what kind of thinking did you do on that before actually working it out?
Well, that was the biggest problem we faced from the beginning, and this is something that Jerry Robbins and I struggled with the most in putting on the film. You see, the stage, as you point out, the stage is not real. You're once removed from reality. You have the proscenium arch there. You're not into reality, so people can go out of dialogue into dance or out of dialogue into song without a little sense of embarrassment. Film is a very, very real medium, and it doesn't take kindly to stylization, unless it's another fantasy like, let's say, Wizard of Oz. So we struggled with that the most. I was the one who insisted that we open West Side Story on the actual streets of New York. There was no way we were going to be able to get a stylized set such as they had on the stage to work in films. And Jerry was all for it. Bob, I agree with you completely, but you've given me the biggest challenge in the whole picture to put my most stylized dancing, which is in that opening, against the most real backgrounds that we'll have. So we struggled with it. One of the reasons I came up with that helicopter opening was to give people a look at New York, a real New York, but a look they hadn't seen before, a kind of an abstract look at New York, although it was real, to help put them in the mood to accept these kids down the line a little bit dancing in the streets.
And the helicopter opening you're talking about is a long aerial shot of Manhattan, and then it kind of zooms down into where the gang members are.
Right. And then Jerry did something else there, too, that he... when he got the kids out on the street after they went through the playground, if people recall that, they had the Jets walking along, and they didn't just go into a dance. One of the kids kind of swings his arm in sort of a dance movement, and they walk along a couple more steps, and two of the guys do it, and then we got a few more steps, and then three of them do it. And before you know it, he had segued very slowly into dance on the street, and that helped very much ease us into it without that sense of embarrassment.
I'll preface this question by telling you that I love the movie and I love the choreography, but I was wondering if you ever thought, and Jerome Robbins ever thought, that people would almost make fun of the film because these tough macho gang members are breaking into really balletic choreography. I mean, it's modern dance, it's not ballet, but there's some very balletic moves in it.
Right. No, we didn't think so. It had worked. It had worked wonderfully well on the stage. Nobody took any question of that. Didn't take it apart. And of course, Jerry's choreography in the show is also strong and so masculine. You know,
mm-hmm.
We thought it would work. What we had to do was what I was describing to you a while ago was to find ways to make it compatible with the realism of the screen. And I have to feel that the way the film has been received over the years, we were pretty successful in doing that.
Can we go back to your very early career, right after you got out of that shipping room at RKO
right.
and you started editing?
Mm-hmm, sure.
You edited Orson Welles' film Citizen Kane.
That's right.
How much freedom did you have when you were editing that movie?
I had the same kind of freedom I had with any other director that I was working with in those days. People have questioned me about that, and I thought probably Orson, being the kind of hands-on man that he was, had come to the editing room and told me where to cut. He didn't do that at all. I worked with him, as I said, like with other directors. I would get a sequence, get all the film in the sequence. I'd put it into a first cut the way I liked it, first cut the sequence, my version. I'd show it to Orson then, and he might like parts of it. He might ask for a change here or there to use a two-shot rather than a close-up or put this line in some other angle. Well, the usual process you go through between editor and director. I would make those changes, show it to him again, and that was the way it went all the way through the film. I don't think that he ever came into the editing room one time to impose himself on the actual process of editing. But, of course, he had his input in it after I had made my cuts.
That was a film that broke a lot of conventions. What do you think of as the most unconventional thing that you did in the movie?
Well, I think it was number one. It was an unconventional film to start with. You know, you looked at those dailies every day and were kind of dumbfounded at the kind of scenes you were seeing and the compositions you were seeing, the setups, the photography. I think the area that I had the most input in was the breakfast table scene. If people recall that scene that shows a series of very short little interplay pieces, the deterioration of the marriage between Cain and his wife, and the actually, as it now appears in the film, the timing, the rhythm of that whole piece, the speed of the whip pans that we use going from one segment to another, and where the dialogue came in preceding each piece, the whole rhythm of the piece was all developed in the cutting room. It was a brilliant idea, brilliantly shot, but the rhythm and the sense of it as it is on the screen was all developed in the editing room, and I would think that would be the major contribution.
The first film that you directed was Curse of the Cat People. This was in 1944, and it was produced by Val Lewton,
yes.
who also did I Walk with a Zombie and Cat People, The Leopard Man.
Right.
So after you were brought on to finish up that film, you directed The Body Snatcher, which starred
right.
Boris Karloff. This was a 1945 movie. And it's a film in which Karloff supplies a teaching doctor with freshly killed bodies for the doctor's
right.
anatomy lessons. It's a wonderful film. It's really moody and shadowy. And I was wondering, this might be unanswerable, but how you learned to get that kind of dark, shadowy, scary feeling in a film.
Well, it's part of it. Always starts with a story, and everything starts with that script and that story, and that was the nature of that piece, as well as parts of Curse of the Cat People. And Val Lewton, who was a terribly creative and talented producer, had a real knack for coming up with stories that lent themselves to doing that kind of dark, heavy, mysterious, effective kind of filming and look. These were black and white films, by the way, and that also lends itself, I think, more than even color to that sort of film noir kind of look. And we had excellent cameramen at RKO those days who specialized in kind of low-key effects and low-key lighting. And so we planned and staged and photographed that way. Lewton was very interesting. You see, he was such a contrast in his thinking to today's horror stories, which are so filled with the blood and gore and monsters and things. Lewton didn't deal in that with his films. He always felt that the greatest fear the audience has is the fear of the unknown, such as, did you hear that? hey, what's that shadow over there? That kind of thing. That could be as scary to audiences and more than the specifics. And so that's why most of the films that Val was involved in had that kind of look and feeling that you could never really be sure what was out there behind that corner in the dark beyond what you could see.
Well, you mentioned shadows. I think the first time you see Boris Karloff, what you're really seeing is a shadow.
That's right. You just see a shadow. It's kind of scary.
Now, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi were in this film. How did they feel about being in horror films for so long? Do you know?
I didn't talk to them too much about that. Boris was very keen about doing The Body Snatcher because if anybody in the audience knows the film, it's really a kind of an acting tour de force for him in his two or three marvelous scenes with Henry Danielle, who plays the doctor. It's a real kind of contest between the two. And Boris was very anxious to do it because he wanted to prove to the people of the business that he was an actor, not just a person to put in horror films, you know, a monster, that he was not just a monster. So that was what his concentration was on. And Lugosi came in as kind of an afterthought. He wasn't in the original script. The studio decided it would be a very good idea if they could put Lugosi and Karloff on the marquee. So Mr. Luton, who was a very talented writer as well, added in the part of the porter that Lugosi played. And Lugosi didn't work very long, just a few days, and he was not very well. He was not well at all. I had to kind of nurse him through the part as it was. So I didn't really get into any conversations with them about how they felt, except that I knew that Boris was very anxious to shed that image and show that he could do something beyond just be a monster.
Mm-hmm. Since you started as a film editor and then became a director and producer, I'm curious if editing movies affected your approach as a director.
I suppose to a certain extent. You don't do it consciously, but obviously, knowing film and knowing what you can do with the film in the cutting room does affect you. Many people have the idea that if you've been a film editor and turned director that you would shoot much less film because you would know just exactly how you want it to go together, but that's not the case, really, certainly not with me. As a former editor, you know how valuable it is to have good coverage, a lot of coverage down in that cutting room. So later on, after the picture's finished shooting, we could do a lot more if you have a lot of angles. If you take a picture out to a preview and have a bad laugh someplace in the scene, you need to cut a line out. If you have that extra angle up there on the shelf you've never used, you bring it down and cut it in, it allows you to lose the line. There's just so much flexibility in the cutting room that former editors, I think, tend to shoot more film.
You've made so many movies. Do you have any favorites among them?
Not a single one. I don't know whether most directors do or not. I do know Gaz Kazan has. I've read something where he said yes very quickly, America, America, but that was his own story, you know, so it was kind of autobiographical in a sense. I don't have. I've done, this was my 39th film, Rooftops. I have maybe 10 or 12 out of those that I would prefer or like better for one reason or another. You've named a number of them, West Side Story, and Sound of Music, Day of the Earth Stood Still, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, The Haunting, The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen, I Want to Live, if I didn't mention that, Andromeda Strain, about a dozen.
Okay, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Filmmaker Robert Wise speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Wise died in Los Angeles last week at the age of 91.